This is WCRS right here in Greenwood, and I have Senator Tim Scott on the line. How you doing today, Senator Tim Scott?
It is always good to be on the line with the lovely Ann on the I Love Ann show. I'm doing fantastic.
I'm glad to hear that, Tim Scott. I'm glad to hear that, Senator. And I have one, probably the most important question we are going to discuss this morning. I want to ask it first. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. I need to know, did you get your picture taken with Willie and Corey Robinson of Duck Dynasty?
That is the most important question that should be asked. I did not have the good fortune, as my good friend Jeff Duncan did, as he got his picture taken at the State of the Union. I did, however, at the Coca-Cola 600, have the opportunity to get my picture taken with Mr. Willie himself.
Wow. Okay. So even though you didn't do there, you already had your picture taken then, I guess.
Absolutely. Those guys are solid Christian fellows from all I can tell, and they do a great job for the conservative cause.
Absolutely. Well, I just noticed that everybody was tweeting out these pictures. I hadn't seen one of you, so I thought I better ask.
I wish I would have gotten another one, but I'm glad that I had the one that preceded my friends in the States, that there's a competition.
Okay. Well, there you go. Tim Scott, score one. Well, listen, you know, there's a lot of issues. Of course, the president had his State of the Union address, and I know you put something out on that. But do you have any further thoughts now that you've had a little bit more time? And, of course, y'all have been in session since the president's State of the Union address.
And thank you for asking that question. Truthfully, our country finds itself in such a challenging position on so many fronts. Our president's State of the Union did not provide much opportunity for us to be hopeful, but in the end, what we have realized is that there is an opportunity to move our country forward, and that's going to take real effort on the part of Congress, especially those of us in the Republican Party, to bring focus to the absolute need for better skills for our folks in the job market so that they can get better jobs. The president believes in bigger government provides bigger solutions, even though the last 6 years, 5.5 years, have proven that more government means lower performance, higher cost, and less opportunity.
And I know that you had actually, after this, called on him to go ahead and pass your Skills Act that you already have in the Senate.
Exactly. The Skills Act is a great way to get job training opportunities to the people who need it the most, number one. Number two, it has been passed in a form in the House already, so our conservatives in the House have agreed to it. And number three, there is a great opportunity, if we take advantage of it, to see more people at work. There are 4 million vacancies today around the country that could be filled if the folks in the jobs market had the right skills, and we aim to help that gap be filled.
Well, you know, here in South Carolina, there are a lot of programs already going on. Our local Piedmont Tech, and I know this was an initiative that the governor put out there, this South Carolina Manufacturing Certification is a big program, and that's an easy program for people to get into and sign up and get certified.
Exactly. There are a number of successful models that already exist. Unfortunately, the federal government often feels like if it doesn't lead, the program is not very good. We have actually experienced the exact opposite. When we see our states and our local governments doing things, we should be willing to follow when we have lack of leadership at the top of the helm. So the programs that you've just described and other programs around the country are factually producing better results than the quagmire pit that we have in Washington.
Sure. Now that kind of leads me to my next question. The president brought up the bit about paying federal contractors minimum wage of $10.10. I know this is something that is going to be taken up in the Senate. I believe I read somewhere in March. What is your feeling about the minimum wage?
Well, I think the president acting unilaterally is just a bad decision on his part, consistent with his last 5 years in office, but not in the best interest of the American people, number one. Number two, if we're going to have a conversation about income inequality and minimum wage, the fastest path forward is for us to restore the 40-hour work week. The 40-hour work week that's been decimated by Obamacare gives more people better opportunities to experience more money, more take-home pay in their paychecks than a debate over a minimum wage.
So your position on this would be?
Well, I think the right debate for us to have right now, if we're looking for ways to improve our economy, put more people back at work, is to debate how we restore the 40-hour work week and save the minimum wage debate for another day. It is ultimately going to cost us more jobs than it creates, and the quality of life that people experience can be better improved not by increasing the minimum wage, but by increasing access to opportunities through skills, through education, and restoring the 40-hour work week.
Well, that would be making a big cut into what the president says about the policies for businesses and what is part-time and what is full-time.
Absolutely. That's one of the glaring facts. Too many jobs that we're seeing created today are seasonal and part-time, and not enough of them are full-time. When we look at the folks who are working full-time, I think the number is around 2 or 3% of those folks working full-time make the minimum wage. The minimum wage is a great political argument. It has an approval rating around 75% of Americans say we should increase the minimum wage. That's a great political argument. Unfortunately, the facts on the minimum wage are very different. The facts are fewer than 3% of the workforce wage, and most of those folks are in their first job under the age of 25 and getting the basic skills so that they can be successful. That's a very different picture that is truly being painted by the president than the facts.
So that means that, would you think that there should be a two-tier wage? First job wages versus those in the market that have been there for a while?
Works currently, that's basically what happens. The first thing that happens is if you are in your first job, you typically make, if you are in restaurants, fast food places, movie theaters, you're making the minimum wage. But after 6 months to a year, you're making more than the minimum wage.
Sure.
That's for those folks who are experiencing the first job and they're under the age of 25. The truth of where we are from a job and an economy standpoint is that virtually no one working full-time makes the minimum wage.
That was kind of where I was thinking that things were, because I don't know of anybody that does that has a full-time job.
That's really where the rubber meets the road. We should have a conversation about moving the middle class forward. We should have a conversation about getting people the right skills so that they can make the best wage possible. We should have a conversation about the failure of our education system to produce the type of product that is employable at a significantly higher wage. If we were to have those conversations, we would then have eliminated the need to have the conversation on the minimum wage.
Absolutely. Now, I know next week, I know you want to talk about Choice Act, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. But I wanted to ask you about the unemployment extension, because that's supposed to come up for a vote in the Senate, I believe, next week. Harry Reid has already said that he has about 55 votes for it. He needs a few more. Where are you going to stand on that, Tim?
The most important question we should ask ourselves about the unemployment insurance is, does it help people get a job after 2 years of being unemployed? And the facts and the statistics are very simple. It does not. However, the second most important question we should ask ourselves, since we already have determined that it's not necessarily a policy that produces more jobs, is it paid for? We continue to use an emergency situation that's been around now for 5 years in order to justify 90 plus weeks of unemployment insurance. The truth is that we have a responsibility to either pay for that unemployed insurance, or we should simply not move forward with it being extended. That's the argument that I'm going to have. Those are the issues that I need to have solved before I can put myself in a position to vote yes or no for it. Those are the prerequisites to me being able to determine what's best for the country.
Now, the policy that's coming up, or the vote that's going to be coming up, it's just for 3 months, though, not for, didn't it have 6 months additional on it or something?
Right. It's just a three-month extension. But once again, what our Democratic colleagues want is 3 months not paid for, just more unemployed insurance for a short period of time, which doesn't solve the problem, doesn't pay for it, and doesn't deal with the fact that we need to solve the problem by providing more skills and better education.
Absolutely. So what do you think on your Skills Act? What do you think? Is it going to come back up? Is it going to come up in the Senate? Is it something that's going to go through? Is Harry Reid going to bring it up?
I am hopeful that Harry Reid will see the benefits of doing the right thing for the American people by giving an up or down vote on the Skills Act. This is an opportunity for us to see more folks go back to work and make more money because they earn it. One of the beauties of work is work brings with it dignity. And I want people to experience their highest potential, but we want people to earn that when possible. And if you're unable to work, that's one thing. But if you're unwilling to work, that's a whole different conversation.
I know, and I think that that the length of time, it does make people unemployable.
With great compassion, we should look for the fastest route to employment. And unfortunately, the president and our friends on the left have dismantled the welfare to work programs that President Clinton and a Republican-controlled Congress put in place 17, 18 years ago. If we were to restore the notion of welfare to work, I think we'd have more people back at work. We have the lowest participation rate in our job force, in our workforce, than we've had since the 60s.
Wow. That's unbelievable. Now, Tim, I know that you spend a lot of time, particularly when you're back here in South Carolina, talking to students, inspiring them to stay in school and learn. And you've also come up with the Choice Act, which I'm very interested in, because it's a path that suits children with disabilities and those living on military bases. Why did you make that choice for the Choice Act?
Yeah, that's good. Well, the choice for the Choice Act. You're good, Ann. You're very good. I'll tell you, from my experience, having toured places like Walgreens Distribution Center in Anderson County, here's a place where 40% of the workforce are disabled folks. They have the highest production of any Walgreens Distribution Center in the country. What I've learned by talking to my friends, who have special needs and kids who have special needs is that they have amazing potential if they get the right atmosphere and culture for their education. There's a wonderful story about a young lady named Rachel Lewis who has Down syndrome. Her parents had to fight to keep her in mainstream classes because they saw the potential in her. Unfortunately, after doing battle and finally winning, they realized that the very teachers who had fought to keep little Rachel out of their classes would then be responsible for educating Rachel. So they sent her to a wonderful school called Hidden Treasure, a private school for kids with special needs, and the results are remarkable. They truly were able to get her through high school. She earned her diploma, and she now not only has one job, but she has two jobs. This is why my Choice Act focuses on creating portability, or allowing the parents to choose the school that best fits the needs of the student. And by doing so, the dollars are then going to go to the best school that fits the needs of the student. And that is a major part of the Choice Act, because we believe that creating open opportunities for individuals and communities happens through education, and we're going to continue to focus on that. And then But those students who live on military bases where their parents are putting their lives on the line, we believe that they should, too, have the choice in their education. Their parents should be able to choose the best school for them, especially when the best school is not close to the base. And so school choice, giving opportunities for those kids to go to a better school if they can't find a good one by the base, I think gives great peace of mind to the parents and a better opportunity for the students.
Now, this Choice Act is for these two groups. Is that specifically what you're targeting there, Tim?
There are three groups, and the third group is the DC Opportunity Scholarship, which is another program that for kids trapped in failing schools in the DC market, they too would have an opportunity to take their tax dollars to a school that best fits their needs. And by doing so, we've seen that over 5,000 students have gone through the Opportunity Scholarship in D.C. 97% of those kids are graduating from high school. And when you're not in an Opportunity Scholarship school, only 56% of the students graduate. I'm also a co-sponsor with Senator Lamar Alexander on a larger, broader bill that provides more choice in education to a host of students living in low-income households, Title I schools that are failing, and or who have special needs as well.
So, and this will be a program coming through the federal government?
Yes, ma'am.
So, and then the dollars would go to the states, and then the states would put it out? Is that how that would be operated?
Basically, the states would have to be willing to participate. There are no mandatory decisions made by the federal government through my bill that requires states to do something. From my perspective, it's really important for us to remember the Constitution really provides states' rights, and as a supporter of states' rights, I think it's very important for us to give greater flexibility to the states and not dictate to the states what they have to do.
Sure. Okay, I have two more questions. One, I know the Farm Bill is headed over there. One of the things, of course, the Farm Bill reduced 1% annual cuts to food stamps. Do you have any idea what you're going to be doing on the Farm Bill?
The Farm Bill has just passed the House. It's heading to the Senate. We have not had an opportunity to see it. I am skeptical on 1,000-page bills just instantly. This is another one. I think it's 957 pages or 1,000 pages. Now, there's a 1% cut to the food stamps, I hear, which means there's about an $8 billion increase over the next 10 years. Only the federal government has cuts that increase the spending, by the way. It's a remarkable thing. As well as there's about a 4% cut to farmers, but there's also an end to the direct payments to farmers. So there are some positives, not many, and some negatives that I've seen on the surface, but we have to dig into the legislation. As you know, Ann, the devil's in the details.
Absolutely. And what did you think about what came out on Benghazi, the report that came out that they knew that night that it was a terrorist attack? And I'm talking to Trey Gowdy next week, so I know I'll get more details. But what was your reaction to hearing that, that we knew all along that this wasn't about a movie, that it was a terrorist attack? But what do you feel about what you've heard since then?
Well, it saddens me, honestly. I mean, we're talking about four Americans who will never breathe again. This is far more than a political issue. This is an issue of life. And we owe the families someone being held accountable. We keep hearing that the State Department is accountable, but no one's been fired. No one's been reprimanded. There's been no action taken against anyone. We need to focus our attention on finding solutions. And unfortunately, folks on the Judiciary Committee will have an opportunity again, I believe, to take this issue up. This is something that we should not let lie dormant. It is in our best interest to solve this mystery. Unfortunately, former Secretary of State Clinton and her department has not been held accountable whatsoever. I think that's a travesty.
Absolutely. Well, Senator Tim Scott, anything else you'd like to enlighten us with today?
Well, God bless you, and thank you for the time. And I look forward to being back on the I Love Ann show as soon as you'll have me back.
All right. Thank you so much, Senator Tim Scott. God bless, and keep up the good work.
You take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.